Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Have you heard about the Connecticut Urban Forest Council? Well, we're going to meet their top official and learn how the council is working to provide advice, assistance, education, information, and support to urban and forestry professionals, volunteers, and to local communities. And we'll learn about their latest project and plans to plant thousands of new trees in several of Connecticut's cities. Will you be seeing a patch of new trees in your neighborhood? Stay tuned. Then we're going to circle back with the CEO of the Connecticut Paid Leave Authority. Did you know you might be eligible to apply for this program right now? We'll get a refresher on what this innovative program is all about and what you need to know right now, whether you're an employer or employee. And we're going to close visiting with our friends from the Red Cross. Your regional Red Cross agency is not only reminding state residents about critical blood donor shortages, but about a range of volunteer opportunities in their disaster services division and elsewhere across Connecticut, providing you a fantastic way to serve your neighbors and those facing some of life's worst situations. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Connecticut NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, is presenting its 40th Winter Conference to be held virtually starting February 11th, offering over 20 workshops on farming, seed saving, organic land care, community food security, social justice issues, and more. Learn, grow, innovate, and think critically with NOFA and their guest experts about what our food and farming look like in the future. Conference registration for all live sessions and exclusive access to all recordings and pre-recorded content this year is available, and NOFA is also offering a sliding scale pricing model for admission. For more details and registration, visit ctnofa.org/winterconference22. Always excited to meet and greet and promote an organization in the state of Connecticut that is doing such great work for the environment. I have no issue admitting that I certainly don't know about all of the offices that populate our state government. And I was so excited to learn recently about the Connecticut Urban Forest Council. They're a statewide organization composed of folks from environmental organizations, state agencies, universities, research institutions, corporations, professional communities, and citizen tree groups. And they provide advice, assistance, education, information, and support to urban and community forestry professionals, as well as municipal, state, and corporate leaders, as well as volunteers. And I'm excited to talk to their chair this morning and welcome her to For the People for the first time. Heather Dion's on the line with us. Heather, thanks for coming by this morning.
Thank you for having me.
So we saw some exciting information about how your organization is going to be going to a number of key communities throughout Connecticut in the coming months, planting trees. And I'm guessing, if the report was correct, you're targeting certain areas that are currently bereft of a lot of trees, and also the initiative to plant more and larger trees to, I guess, get a real jump start on the benefits that those trees can provide to communities, and they are many. We're going to talk about a lot of them today. But first, let's get to know you a little bit more. Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to be part of the Urban Forest Council.
Sure. So I've been in the tree industry for a little over 20 years. I am Connecticut native, born in Coventry. I just took a liking to trees, followed that passion, went to school for it, got my undergrad in that, and just continued to build on my knowledge and experiences through various jobs and positions. I firsthand, at one point in my career, was working in a bucket truck where I was doing tree maintenance, running chainsaw, running a crew. And then I ended up with the city of Hartford as their city forester, where I've been there for almost 10 years. My 10-year anniversary is in April. And a few, several years ago, I was asked to attend an Urban Forest Council meeting, and they were up for elections, right? And someone put my name in the hat.
Well, I was going to say, given the fact that you're, kind of the point person for forestry in the city of Hartford, which a lot of people know has a very kind of diverse eco-culture. I mean, it's not all pavement and skyscrapers. There are some beautiful tracts of open space, obviously a broad riverside estuary area, some wonderful parks and forest areas within the city, sharing a lot of those tracks with neighboring communities. So you seem acutely qualified for both the positions, and they probably do serve each other both very well.
They really do. Yes.
Let's talk a little bit more then about the Urban Forest Council and the work that you're doing. I understand that one of our good friends, DEEP Commissioner Katie Dykes and their forestry division are working with you guys because, as she has discussed with us and her predecessors, you really can't get enough trees. They say they're not making any more land, but they certainly are continuing to provide more trees that can go on the land that we have, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And with what we're dealing with in terms of climate change and invasive insects, at the droughts, the severe storms, we're losing canopy at a fairly rapid pace. So if we're not planting, especially in urbanized areas where, you know, trees don't really self-seed themselves, as opposed to like forested areas, our landscape needs folks like myself to make sure that that happens.
Well, are we in a situation now here going into the 20th year of the new century, you know, into 2022, actually 22nd year, second decade, and moving toward the third here, are we in a situation where the natural organic tree population is hitting like the 100 to 200 year mark, and for the types of trees that are best sustainable here in Connecticut in our soils and communities are just aging out and dying off? Or are we at a point where there was a significant effort to plant trees 50, 75, 100 years ago, and that population of trees is now aging out, falling down, getting cut down, dying, or are being wiped out due to development?
So I'd say it's a combination of both. I mean, we definitely have some older, more mature trees that are, you know, reaching their expiration. Here in Hartford, for example, there's several that I tend to more frequently and more delicately because of their age and because of their significance in the city. So, you know, those trees require extra care. They're the powerhouses. They're the ones that give us the most bang for our buck. They're the ones who, filter the most particulates out of the air, store the most carbon, take up the most stormwater, create the most shade, all of that. So we want to keep those trees healthy and standing for as long as possible. Granted, we also are contending with, you know, trees that were planted, say, you know, maybe 70 years ago or 50 years ago, like our Norway maples. I've just been noticing, because of the droughts that we've had over the past 5-6 years, we had like 3 seasons of really, really, really serious drought. Those trees are dying. So even though they're not super, super old, it's just they're at their point where, you know, if we don't take them down, they become dangerous. So that's another thing to consider. And then another thing, obviously, is development. You know, you want to create areas that'll thrive, but you also need to make sure that those who are doing the developing are considering tree planting. So in our city, in Hartford, we have a very detailed tree ordinance. And part of that ordinance includes developers having to replace inch per inch of what's been lost, you know, what's been approved to be taken down. There are instances where, say, there's a legacy tree, you know, a tree of significant importance that I will tell them flat out, no, you can't remove this tree. You need to work around it. So, you know, we do a lot of preservation, you know, enforcement, mm-hmm. All of that, because it's necessary. You can't just take a 80-year-old tree and put it in the landscape.
Sure.
You know, and of course, now if you're starting to plant trees that are, you know, been growing for, say, 8-10 years, and you're putting them out in the landscape, you can't just leave them. You can't just say, okay, there you go. Like, it's planted. That's it. I'm going to walk away. Those young trees require a significant amount of TLC,
sure.
Similar to like a baby, mm-hmm. You know, lots of water. You know, you have to get that tree established at least for a few years, and then you can kind of walk away and say, all right, I think you're going to be okay, unless, of course, it gets hit by a car or,
right.
You know,
oh, sure.
All the other circumstances.
Yeah.
Well, but you know what I'm saying? It's,
yeah, yeah.
It takes a lot of our work.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Heather, but I've been noticing more over the past 20 years or so that Connecticut cities and towns are taking more steps to care for and sustain a lot of the tree population. I remember, you know, back in my younger days, you know, the first call would be the guy with the biggest chainsaw. And now both utility companies and municipalities, as well as, you know, private community organizations and volunteer initiatives are working to maintain trees a little bit better so that they live and sustain a little bit longer. Is that the case?
I believe so. I know in Hartford that is definitely the case. And, you know, that's something I think I've had a bit of an influence in changing the narrative and how people think about trees. And actually, that's been a lot of the feedback that I've received, you know, via social media or what have you, explaining to people why it's important to do what we do, because people really don't know. Like, if a tree is dropping leaves in the fall, I get those calls sometimes, right? I don't want to pick up my leaves. I want you to take my tree down. Mm. You know, and it's like, no, but listen, this tree is here because, you know, so your grandchild hopefully doesn't develop asthma, you know,
mm-hmm.
or whatever reason, the collective proper care and maintenance of our urban forest benefits humanity like tenfold. And that's been my, I think, my mission,
mm-hmm.
is just getting people to understand how selfless these organisms, like, you know, these organisms are.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're
also facing, you know, damage and life compromising issues with foreign invasives, right? Especially insects here in Connecticut lately.
Yep, that is exactly correct. So we've lost a bunch of ash trees due to emerald ash borer. We've been losing oaks throughout the state because of, one, the drought, and then our insect that's very notorious for coming in like secondary after some sort of stress is the two-line chestnut borer. So that's been hitting oaks. We've been spraying the past 2 years in our parks,
mm-hmm.
just to save our oak trees because they're a significant part of our landscape.
Yeah.
I was just contacted by the USDA 2 days ago asking about setting traps in Colt Park for Asian longhorn beetle, which is kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah,
that's a biggie.
The hits just keep on coming, I guess.
They just keep coming.
And it takes a combination of people like you who can articulate the danger to the either uninducted or uninterested citizens about the many benefits. And it's also a part of the reason in the last few minutes that we have to just remind people of this planting initiative that's coming up, almost a couple $100,000 going into some areas of key cities. Before we say farewell to you today, let's get an update on that.
Yeah, so we are working diligently because this is the first time that the state has provided so much funding for urban forestry at once. So I really, that's huge. And I want to thank Commissioner Dykes and Deep Forestry for that. But Bridgeport, New Haven, Stratford, Greenwich, and Windsor are all communities that were able to show their need for tree replacement and planting because they have areas in impoverished areas, right, that are lacking in tree canopy cover. So the environmental justice aspect is huge, and just planning ahead, for those neighborhoods.
Yeah, and I guess, with the goal of planting about 3,000 trees per year for the next 50 years across Connecticut, and in just Hartford alone, that really should send the clear message to anyone listening and communities across the state of how everyone needs to step up and consider tree planting programs as a critical municipal infrastructure initiative. And I guess they can call on the Connecticut Urban Forest Council and the DEEP Forestry Division for assistance in making programs like that happen. Folks, if you're interested in learning more, you can go to cturbanforestcouncil.org to learn more about what this organization is doing. And in closing, Heather, any other critical information that folks need to know, or are there easy ways that folks can try to form a volunteer effort and maybe bundle buy some tree seedlings to be able to start this initiative in their own community, even if they're not one of the ones benefiting from this latest injection of underwriting from the state?
Yeah. So, there's a second round of funding that's just becoming open, I think in February, if it hasn't already now. So there's going to be about another five more communities that are going to benefit from the funding of this program. Also, almost every single town in Connecticut has a tree warden. So if you don't know who your tree warden is, get in contact with them. So I also sit on their board. Mm-hmm. It's a very tight-knit community, and we can make things happen. We've been working with Eversource. Eversource has, given out seedlings. We can brainstorm. And honestly, even if you're just a solo property owner, and you have room in your yard or, wherever, plant a tree. Right. Or plant 10 trees, please.
Yes. With 3,000 per year for the next 50 years required in Hartford alone to get the tree canopy up to 25% to 35%, it's obvious that any Connecticut municipality, however urban, rural, or in between they are, get planting, get trees, and get them in the ground, and spend that critical first 3 to 5 years with the necessary attention and maintenance required to ensure that those trees are there for our children, our grandchildren, and their children. We appreciate your time, Heather Dion, not just the point person for forestry in the municipality of Hartford, but chair of the Connecticut Urban Forest Council. CTUrbanForestCouncil.org is their website, and they are there to assist and support urban and community forestry professionals, volunteers, municipalities, and others. It was great to meet you, Heather, and we're going to be back talking to you again about this initiative after the second round, perhaps back in the springtime, to figure out where some other cities may be able to get some traction on this. So thank you for being with us this morning. Well, 2022 is a big year for a relatively new program here in Connecticut. I'm talking about the Connecticut Paid Leave Initiative, and we've got a familiar friend back on the line with us. Andrea Barton Reeves is the CEO of the Connecticut Paid Leave Authority, and they're serving a growing need by providing financial relief to Connecticut families, allowing individuals to care for loved ones or themselves without having to worry about lost income. And right now, here we are, January 2022. We were joking a little bit before we turned on the microphone, Andrea, but you know, we have been together with you guys from early on in the building process up to January 1st, 2022, when the program essentially became effective for applicants. So congratulations for helping shepherd this brand new, innovative, and much needed program so far.
Thank you very much, and Happy New Year to you and all of your listeners. We are excited to be back, and there is a lot to report. We started taking applications for benefits in December, which was probably a month earlier than we had anticipated, so we were very glad to be able to do that. And in the first 2 hours, we had 400 claims. So we know people were ready and waiting to file. And as of today, we have about 5,600 claims that have been filed for all kinds of reasons, mostly pregnancy and childbirth and bonding with children who are new to families through birth, adoption, or foster care. Okay. So we're excited. Yeah, great.
Well, before we talk about what else there is to look forward to and what people need to know now that you've sort of crossed the January threshold and applications are rolling in, let's flash back to the humble beginnings of this initiative and just remind people a little bit about how this paid leave initiative came about here in Connecticut.
Yeah, so it came about when Governor Lamont signed the bill into law in 2019. So that was in July. Then a board was appointed, and then I came on board in March of 2020, literally 7 days before the pandemic hit and the world shut down. But I and my team have been working diligently over the last 2 years to make paid leave a reality. So in the first year, when you and I talked about this time last year, we were introducing the 0.5% of pay that was going to fund the trust fund. And so far, we have 124,000 employers and about $301 million in the trust fund. So people have been extraordinarily cooperative in really one of the most challenging times I think many of us have seen in our lifetimes. And then the next milestone was the one that we just hit this month, which is the ability to be able to now access that benefit and get a portion of what's in that $301 million trust fund to cover qualified reasons for leave. And you know, those include your own serious health condition, which is pregnancy and childbirth, caring for people who've been injured in the military, supporting a family member who's going to be deployed overseas. And in our state, we also allow for up to 12 days of paid leave for those who are affected by family violence. There's also caregiver leave that's available. So if you have to care for someone who has a serious health condition, you are also able to take up to 12 weeks of paid leave for that purpose. So that's how we started, and that's how we've built things up over the last 2 years, I should say.
Okay, well, let's take a quick pause there and look at a couple of things that have been happening. Since you have this fairly decent influx of participating employers, where do you stand now in terms of the percentage of those who are signed on and potentially, you know, the ballpark idea of those yet to get involved?
Yeah, so thank you. It's a great question. We have, I mentioned, is 124,000 employers, which is well above the 108,000, which was our target. And that's essentially the same number of employers who have an obligation to pay unemployment insurance to the Department of Labor.
Okay.
But we have a larger category of employers that aren't necessarily covered through DOL but have employees. And sometimes, you know, it's churches and other places, and that's for another time. So we think that we're probably at about the 75 to 80% mark when it comes to the number of employers we need to have who are registered. Our numbers, and we gather numbers from the Department of Revenue Services and the Department of Labor, tell us that we have about 10,000 employers who should be registered according to our records and are not. So we'll start reaching out to them. They will probably get some kind of communication in the next week or so to remind them that this is something that they need to do.
And for those who may be listening or know someone, someone's listening who knows someone who's got their own small business or may not yet be participating, can you reflect a little bit about what you're hearing from employers? Because I guess the initial concern was, this is just the Connecticut keeps piling on with the taking more and more, not just time, but the administrative work, the added paperwork, and speak to the early critics now that you've actually got tens of thousands of employers who are on board. I mean, this certainly sounded like it was much worse in the suspicions than it ended up being in reality.
I think that's true, but part of the reason that I think we've been more successful in getting employers to participate is that we listened to them. We heard them when they said, it sounds like it's going to be burdensome. We believe that it's just, another tax and another reason to lower the pay of workers. We're concerned about workers not coming to work because now their family and medical leave will be paid. And we need you to hear us and address that. And so we did, by making the registration process very easy and the remittance of that 0.5% really simple, by giving them a lot of tools on our website and designing the website so that it is much more customer focused and they can find what they need and they don't have to do all of the heavy lifting to inform their employees about what's going on. And we've heard from employers that works for them and they can see that we've made that effort and that they appreciate it.
Excellent.
It still doesn't really address the need about, what's going to happen if 4 of my 7 people go out at the same time. We can be very sympathetic to that, but we would never say that we have the answer. And it is truly a different environment for our small businesses and our small employers. But what we did to address that is we partnered with the state Small Business Development Center to give employers access to resources that can help them at least begin to find workers if they do find themselves in that circumstance. So we're trying to address the needs as they arise and as they've been articulated to us.
Great. Let's take a quick pause, Andrea, and do a quick break and a PSA, and we're going to come back and talk more about things that employers and employees or those coming into the workforce may need to know about the Connecticut Paid Leave Program. Andrea Barton Reeves is with us. She's CEO of the Connecticut Paid Leave Authority. Stay with us. We'll be back. We've got lots more great information for you. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. So maybe you made a resolution to improve your health in the new year. We've got an answer for you. Griffin Health is helping individuals get a fresh perspective on well-being with a new session of their Wellness for Life program starting February 15th in Oxford. Wellness for Life is a 12-week lifestyle change program that's designed to equip folks who are ready to take ownership of their health with lifestyle medicine knowledge and skills using evidence-based approaches in eating healthfully, managing stress, achieving regular physical activity and restorative sleep, as well as fostering meaningful social connections and support systems to improve your quality of life and prevent and manage chronic conditions. If you'd like more information about Wellness for Life or to register, call 203-732-1369 or just go to griffinhealth.org. Well, thanks for sticking with us or joining us. The CEO of the Connecticut Paid Leave Authority is on the line with us, Andrea Barton Reeves, who has been with us here before on the award-winning For the People. They're providing employees pathways to accessible paid family leave benefits. And as we heard, not just January 1st, but earlier in the process, they began accepting applications. Now hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of applications in play and well past their goal of getting employers signed up. Andrea, let's revisit one of the subjects that we talked about in our earlier conversations, and that is for the owner operators, because even a single employee operation can be involved in this process, but certainly there are hundreds, thousands of owner-operators, situations, landscapers, painters, individuals who may just have one or two employees, or perhaps family members who are employees. Speak to those individuals who may not yet be part of the system.
Those actually are the employers that we're finding that don't realize that they need to be part of the program. There are some misconceptions about which employers are covered because the law is very broad. And for those employers that may do business in other states that may be adjacent or close to us, like Massachusetts, for example, the rules are a little different, so it can be a bit confusing. But the employers that you described as an example that have one or more employees, they actually are covered by the paid leave program. And they are required to register and withhold that 0.5% from employee wages and contribute that to the fund. But what we've heard from a lot of small businesses is that the paid leave benefit is one that they would not be able to provide on their own, because small businesses have resources that are honestly more limited than sort of our much larger employers. So now when someone needs to go out because they're having a baby, or maybe they have a very serious health condition, employers have been struggling with how to keep that person on their payroll or provide some sort of wage replacement while they're out because they really value them. Now they don't have to have that struggle anymore. That person can come to the paid leave authority. We will provide some degree of wage replacement, and that employer can then have the opportunity to have that person return to them without thinking about how are they going to continue to pay them while they're away.
Okay. So in the last, 5 minutes or so that we have with you, let's punch up a couple of questions here that are extremely topical, especially with the Omicron variant of COVID-19 running rampant here in Connecticut. Talk to us a bit about whether or not the paid leave program covers COVID-related absence.
Well, the answer is it depends. And I'm not answering it that way because I'm a lawyer, because that really is the answer. It really does depend. It depends on whether or not your COVID symptoms rise to the level of what's known as a serious health condition, which actually has a legal definition. And it essentially means that you are under the constant care of a doctor. It's so chronic that you have to be hospitalized, or it's so chronic that you really cannot work for an extended period of time based on the assessment of a healthcare provider. So those are just some general examples. And some people may be saying, well, what do you mean COVID is not a serious health condition? I feel horrible. And that's true. But you almost have to be at the point where you're at the hospital or a healthcare provider says this person really cannot work for an extended period of time. And then you may qualify for the paid leave benefit. The same is true for someone who may be caring for someone who is so incapacitated by COVID that they must then become their caregiver. And that person may also be able to apply for the benefit to care for the person while they recover.
Okay, but it's a case-by-case evaluation.
It is absolutely a case-by-case evaluation. Absolutely right.
All right, super. Then basically give us the lowdown and all of our employers and employees that are listening of where they need to go and what they need to do here in the first few weeks of the new year, particularly those who may want to find out about applying.
The best thing to do is to visit our website, which is ctpaidleave.org. You can register your business there. You can remit your payments if you haven't done so already. And you can apply for your paid leave benefit all on the same site.
Fantastic. Looking across the almost 5,600 claims received so far, you mentioned the primary reasons of care of a family member, bonding with or recovering from a pregnancy and childbirth, bonding with an incoming addition to the family or employee injury or illness. But, military leave, although it's a fractional number of those claims received. That's another reason. The wonderful saints who are organ donors, some have applied, as well as other individuals who are on a personal protected leave due to family violence. And I think that's a real critical one to mention in the last few moments that we have together. In closing, in 30 or 45 seconds, anything that folks need to know that's going to be added to or happening in 2022 that's new to Connecticut Paid Leave?
No, there aren't any significant anticipated changes to the statute or the program. I think, like everyone, we're waiting to see what's going to happen at the federal level. There's really been no news or movement of late on that, but we wait as well. But the state program is fairly settled. We know what the statute looks like and what the benefits are, and we're just looking forward to helping people have that wage replacement and be able to get back to work.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Andrea. Good to hear your voice again, and we'll be back talking to you again, I'm sure, before we see 2023 roll around. Andrea Barton Reeves is the CEO of Connecticut Paid Leave Authority. Connecticut Paid Leave Program offers income replacement benefits while taking leave to address your personal and family health needs. For employers, it provides the tools and resources to promote a happy, healthy, vibrant, and inclusive workplace and comply with state law. I've seen the website. It's fantastic. If you're an employer in Connecticut, please do visit ctpaidleave.org. And if you're in need of benefits, you can find out more at that website as well, ctpaidleave.org. Andrea, once again, Happy New Year. Andrea, once again, Happy New Year. Last but not least, as promised, we are visiting again with our friends from the American Red Cross. Today, our representative is Sarah Shale. She's a volunteer services officer with the American Red Cross of Connecticut and Rhode Island. This organization serves almost 4 million folks in Connecticut over across its 168 towns, as well as Fishers Island, New York, and Rhode Island. We've got a bunch of activities coming up to tell you about and great opportunities to not just make a huge difference to perhaps an individual by being a blood donor, but by some other volunteer opportunities that can really put your good work to good work, assisting folks who may have been impacted by perhaps one of the worst incidents or incidents or activities of their life as a disaster services volunteer. There's also some other opportunities we're going to be talking about. A virtual open house coming up and a couple of really big important blood drives. So without further ado, Sarah, welcome. Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, John. I appreciate it.
So quickly, a little bit about yourself. Have you been with the Red Cross for quite a while?
So I've been with the Red Cross for about 4 years. I lose track every once in a while, but I believe it's about 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And so as the interim volunteer services officer, are you dealing primarily with folks in Connecticut or across the entire jurisdiction of this division?
So our department covers all of Connecticut and Rhode Island. So we are sort of our HR function internally, and we help volunteers sort of find their place within the organization and provide them support as they navigate their journey with the Red Cross.
And how has the volunteerism factor been over the past couple of years with the virus? Are you finding folks are still willing to step up and help, or are you going into a period of deeper recruitment because of either the retirement or the tide going out for a bunch of volunteers, or folks just being uncomfortable perhaps being as involved because of the potential for coming in contact with the virus?
Yeah, so we've seen some of that. We've definitely have some volunteers who've made the decision for themselves to put their health first and take some steps away from the Red Cross, because a lot of what we do is really in person. Mm-hmm. But then we've also seen a lot of really great community members who've stepped up and seen the importance of making sure people still have access to support after a home fire or need that friendly face at a blood drive, and have been really great and willing to continue showing up. Every time they show up for a shift, we have folks who do 20 blood shifts a month or even more than that. And they're just still there every day, that smiling face to make sure that someone's there to help check in when you show up at a blood drive.
Yeah. Well, January is National Blood Donor Month, and you can't go anywhere without hearing or seeing or learning about news reports talking about the need for blood and platelets, not just for emergencies, but for folks who are undergoing severe illness treatments, and individuals who are undergoing even routine surgery. So let's talk briefly about where we're at in terms of the blood donor program and these two fantastic opportunities coming up next week on January 12th and 13th.
Absolutely. So January is National Blood Donor Month, and January is always a great time to sort of make some new resolutions, and donating blood regularly is definitely one of those. It's also really important right now because there is sort of a rising concern about the nation's blood supply, which has dipped to pretty concerning levels and could potentially force hospitals to hold off on essential blood and platelet transfusion. So donors of all blood types right now, particularly type O, which is the most needed blood group by hospitals, and platelets are definitely in need daily to help meet the demand of our hospital partners across the country.
To the extent that you can talk about it or refer people to where they could go to learn more, essentially the opportunities are very liberal in terms of both who can donate as well as where. But you've got a couple real high profile activities coming up. Before we talk about those on the 12th and 13th, is there anything else folks need to know, or a one stop location that they can go? You guys got an app for that, right?
We have an app for that. And we also, they can go to redcrossblood.org, which will provide all the information. There's a great place to put in your zip code. You can see all the blood drives within your immediate area. And if you have questions about whether you can donate blood, there's a great sort of walkthrough step of helping you determine if you could be an eligible blood donor. So if you've never donated before and you have questions about that, the site can help answer those questions for you.
Yeah, and if people do really want to donate, but they're still a little bit on the edge because of possible longer exposure to a lot of other folks, even in indirect proximity, there's a lot of ways that folks can kind of set up a profile and do some pre-registration, so when they actually arrive at the blood drive, they kind of expedite through the process, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We do have a process where you can sign up beforehand. We are generally requiring, we love it when people make appointments, so that allows you to put all your information in. It's just a process of our folks at the front desk helping make sure checking in so that they can come grab you when your appointment time comes up.
Fantastic. So let's talk about January 12th and 13th, the bullseye here at National Blood Donor Month, right?
Absolutely. So on January 12th, we do have a drive happening at the American Legion Hall in Watertown. And then on January 13th is our big New Year's blood drive. It's one of our biggest drives of the year, and we're going to be hosting drives at Dunkin' Donuts Park and at the West Hartford Town Hall. So if you want to sort of have a unique experience of getting your blood taken in Dunkin' Donuts Park, this would be a great opportunity on January 13th.
Excellent. And you did mention kind of on a national level what the picture is like right now. Do you know or could you say whether or not Connecticut is sort of, you know, at the bottom of the list, middle of the pack, or a little bit more toward the better scenario in terms of need and supplies?
Honestly, I probably wouldn't be the right person to ask that question to, okay. But we can certainly get back to you with that information.
That's fine. Suffice to say, you can never have enough blood and platelet donors at this point in history, whether you're in Connecticut or wherever you may be listening to this podcast, right?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, let's switch gears. If you just are joining us to get ready for our music day, Sarah Shale is with us. She's a volunteer services officer with the American Red Cross of Connecticut and Rhode Island. You can learn more by going to redcross.org/local/Connecticut get all the information about the blood drives we're talking about, as well as something later in the month on January 26th. Let's start talking a little bit about the volunteer virtual open house, Sarah.
Absolutely. So January is not only National Blood Donor Month, but it also kicks off our Resolve to Volunteer campaign. Again, January, a great time to pick up on some new things in your life. And we are going to be hosting a virtual open house where we will be talking about all of our different volunteer opportunities, how you can get involved, different ways that you can interact with the Red Cross, be it if you want to do something in person. We also may have some virtual volunteer opportunities. We'll do our best to sort of help you figure out if the Red Cross is the best fit for you. And you can go to the redcross.org/local/PT to see the registration for that event and get signed up so that you can join us that evening to sort of go over all the great things we have available for folks to do in the community.
Yeah. Well, people, I think, don't really pay much attention to hyper-local disasters, particularly things like residential fires, unless they happen in their neighborhood or they happen to see some passing news report about it. But it is winter time, and statistically, it is a time when more home fires occur. And being a member of the media, every time the Red Cross even sends out a person to or a team to assist one person who's been the victim of a house fire or other hyper-local disaster or issue, I get notified. And man, it's just been every day, or seemingly almost every day over the past 5 or 6 weeks. You guys have been going out not just to assist single families of a few people who might have been impacted by a residential house fire. You guys have faced some major fires, especially that one up in New Hartford a few months ago, where that's displacing dozens of people. So tell us a little bit more about how folks can go to work in their own community and across Connecticut, coming to the aid of people who are in these dire situations, sometimes coming out of their homes with even, you know, less than the clothes on their back. I mean, some of these people are coming out of these burning buildings, in nightgowns wrapped in blankets, right?
Absolutely. And that's sort of our volunteers who show up and are on our disaster action team. They're really the story of those responses, and those names you see are almost always volunteers. And they really are those folks that, like you said, folks are coming out of homes with almost nothing. And the Red Cross's job is to be there to provide them with a pair of socks, a toothbrush, toothpaste, the things that you don't think of when you're having to literally flee your house. And so they are really that first point of contact to give them comfort and care and make sure they have somewhere to stay that night. And honestly, I couldn't imagine being in that situation without the Red Cross there to give me some support. And one of the things that people may not recognize or realize about the Red Cross is we are about 90% volunteer run. So without our volunteers, we literally couldn't do what we do. You wouldn't see us with those red vests in the communities. We just wouldn't have the manpower to do it. So the volunteers really are the backbone of our organization, and particularly our disaster action teams working as our frontline responders to really help those who have been immediately impacted by a home fire. Okay. And more broadly, they're the same folks who would potentially go off to Kentucky or Colorado and provide support and shelters. I know we had some folks who really raised their hands and gave up their Christmases to be in Kentucky and provide support to those folks as well.
So while, you know, there's an occasional opportunity to represent Connecticut elsewhere, it's really all about being there as quickly as possible with as comprehensive level of assistance available in these horrible few moments and hours after someone in their neighborhood or their community is impacted, particularly by residential fires. What is the extent of the commitment an individual might need to make if they wanted to consider being a disaster services volunteer?
So generally speaking, the baseline is that we ask that people be willing to support the Red Cross mission. That's sort of the heart and soul of what we ask our volunteers. And from there, we can provide all the training you need. And you just have to be willing to commit to anywhere from 2 to 4 shifts a month to be willing to be on call to respond to a home fire.
So that's how it works. Once the training is completed, essentially, you're just either picking or assigned allotments of time over the course of a month when you need to basically just be available to answer the call. It's not something where you're potentially can be called 24/7 at any time, unless, of course, there is some disaster warranting it and you need all hands on deck, right?
Exactly. So folks get to sign up for the shift that sort of works best for their schedule. So if someone's a night owl and they really want to sign up from 12 a.m. to 8 a.m., then there's a shift available for that. But then we also have daytime shifts. It's really, again, based on the volunteer's schedule, availability, and really when they want to be available to commit time. Mm.
Is the training and certification something folks do virtually and can do on their own schedule up until the point of completion, at which time they kind of go into the volunteer system? Or do you actually still, in some situations, host in-person training? And if so, or either way, what should people expect if they're considering signing up?
Absolutely. So right now, most of our training is virtual. It is self-paced. So again, if you can't sleep at night, a great way to get through the time is take some Red Cross training. But we are hoping as we sort of move forward a little bit, we'll get back to some of our in-person trainings where folks will be able to meet with other new volunteers and sort of build that community within the Red Cross. But right now, the bulk of it is going to be virtual training, and we have great leadership volunteers who are there to sort of help navigate that process and be a resource for any questions that folks may have as they're going through it.
Great. And in the last couple minutes we have with you, Sarah, you did kind of briefly touch on it when we were talking about blood services, but folks who might want to volunteer for the Red Cross and be an asset, an increased asset in their community and in Connecticut, have another opportunity that's tied to the blood services end to be a kind of a concierge at blood drives?
Absolutely. So we are always looking for blood donor ambassadors. The nice thing is that we have blood drives happening basically every day of the week all across Connecticut. So really anyone in Connecticut can sign up to be a blood donor ambassador and find a location that's fairly close to their house. And this person really is. It's that front desk, that smiling face when you walk into a blood drive that greets you, helps you get checked in. And they may also be that person in the canteen who provides you with a snack when you're finished with your blood donation. So it's a great opportunity for someone who wants to be out in the community, is really a people person, and is just looking for a somewhat easier way to give back that maybe isn't committing to going to home fires. It's a little more stationary, but it, again, it's a great opportunity to be that friendly, smiling face at our blood drives to sort of recognize the great work that our blood donors are doing.
an excellent amount of information and guidance. Sarah Shale is a volunteer services officer with American Red Cross of Connecticut and Rhode Island. Don't forget, right here in January, it's National Blood Donor Month. We really need you. If you haven't been a blood donor, consider becoming one. Type O blood donors particularly needed right now, and consider perhaps even going to work as one of these blood center concierge diplomats, or getting involved in their disaster services and response team. It all starts by visiting and learning more about the American Red Cross in Connecticut at redcross.org/local/Connecticut. And once again, Sarah Shale, thank you so much for being with us this morning, and we hope you have a good rest of the winter and a happy 2022. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.